Roll 2d6. Show number 14. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gamers, and gaming.
Packed episode of Roll 2d6. I'm Adam.
And I'm Nate.
And we are here to continue talking about games. Today, Nate's going to talk about a little bit about a German game that he played recently, but before that, I want to talk about gaming accessories.
Accessories. Who doesn't love a good gaming accessory?
I love good gaming accessories. And I want to talk a bit about a couple of them that I have found to be very useful lately. So, the first thing I want to talk about is Dice Towers.
So not the podcast.
Not Tom Vassell's podcast, Dice Tower. It's talking about possibly the namesake of that podcast. What is a Dice Tower?
Is that what you do when you're playing D&D and you're really bored? Okay, and nothing's going on with your character, so you start stacking your dice to see how high you can get, and if you can balance a 12 on a 20.
I've done that many a time, and we've all been there. And if you do a Google image search for Dice Tower, you will find pictures of that.
Oh, that's
but
hilarious.
What I'm talking about is something different. A Dice Tower is a solution to a very specific gamer problem, and it's something that I initially thought was kind of a frivolous thing, but I've grown to find it useful in many gaming situations.
All right.
So let me describe what the problem is. You're playing a game that involves rolling some dice.
Okay, hold on. I'm not sure I've ever done this. Let me picture this in my mind.
See if you can mentally let it come. Sit back and relax. And
I've got it.
You're playing a game with dice, and the game you're playing is one that has a board with lots of carefully positioned pieces you don't want to knock out of place when you roll those dice.
Oh, absolutely.
So you could be playing Monopoly with houses and hotels on the board spaces. You could be playing Risk with
hundreds of armies
all over the board in every country, or any of hundreds of other games. Now imagine also that the table you're playing this game on is not that big. It's big enough to hold the board with some small margin around the side of the board for your cards, your extra pieces, your can of Mountain Dew, etc.
Okay, I've got it totally pictured in my head now.
Okay, hey, make sure you put a coaster on that can of Mountain Dew.
Oh yeah, it's soaking through.
Okay. Now, when I was a little kid, we always tried to roll the dice right on the board, right in the middle of say, the Monopoly board.
Right. And that's where people aim, usually.
That's where you aim. It doesn't always work, and sometimes you end up knocking someone's hotel off the table, and that's definitely going to make your occupancy rates go down.
That's California Monopoly rather than New York.
That's right. It's hard to get insurance in that situation. Or maybe you're playing Risk and you try to roll in the Atlantic Ocean or on the edge of the board, and inevitably someone's army gets hit by the dice,
right.
Especially with as many dice as you're rolling in Risk.
Absolutely.
So eventually you figure out that, hey, I can roll my dice in the box lid, and that'll keep them off the board. And that also has the advantage that you have walls around the edges of the box lid, and you don't have to roll so softly. You can just toss them in there, they hit the edge, and you get a result. And if your kid's sitting on playing Risk on the floor, as I often did, it's really not a problem to put the giant Risk box lid next to the board and roll your dice right there. But when you have a big board game on the table and not very much room around the edges, it might not be possible to fit that big box lid there.
Well, that's true.
So what's the next progression? You go to a smaller box lid. Maybe you get a shoebox lid.
Oh, yeah.
Or the lid from some other smaller game, like Family Business, the old version of Family Business.
Or you even need to get a lid that has shorter walls so that everyone can still see the dice, because some of the box lids are too tall, and the dice will fall somewhere where you still can't even read them.
Yes, that's exactly the problem you run into when you use a dice a lid. I'm rolling the dice generally away from me. They go towards you. They stop and hit the edge of the box lid, and now you have to lean over to see what they are. So it's a suboptimal situation.
Or I have to believe you, and I've learned never to just believe what you say.
Those were all sixes. And then
you quickly pick them up. That's right.
So what is the solution to this problem? And that solution is a dice tower.
Ta-da!
Which I'll now describe. So they come in all shapes and sizes. I'll describe one that I bought for my cousin Michael.
Hi, Michael.
He's probably listening to this right now. It's a boot-shaped device, so imagine a tower with a little area that comes out on the side, like the base of the boot. And the one I got for Michael, it's made all of wood, made of maple. You drop dice in the top of the boot, and they fall down the tube. They bounce off some baffles, and they end up rolling out the bottom and land in a little felt pit where everyone can see them.
Mm-hmm.
So you put this on the edge of your table, your jam-packed gaming table where you don't have a lot of room. You can drop the dice in and roll them, and everyone can see them. It ensures they're fully randomized, because it is darn hard to make them come up a certain way when you're just dropping them in. And it's a good solution.
Yeah, and I don't have to worry about continually moving my Mountain Dew can so that we can put the lid over by me when it's my turn, because
that's
you just
right.
You have the tower there.
And you're not rolling on the board, which is covered with carefully positioned pieces. So.
Right, the thousands of chits. Of
tons of chits or little minis or whatever.
Right.
So it's a good solution, and I've found it very useful. So that maple dice tower that I described, mm-hmm. that's one I bought from gravediggergames.com. And they have...
Link in the show notes?
Yes, I'll put a link in there.
Are you a paid shill?
No, I'm not a paid...
Okay,
I'm
just making sure.
I'm a happy customer.
Full disclosure. Good. Just making
right.
sure.
And they have a bunch of different ones there. They make them out of different wood, and they decorate them. But if you do a Google search for Dice Tower, in fact, do a Google image search for mm-hmm. Dice Tower, and you'll see a whole bunch of ones that people have made out there on the
right.
web. Some of them are very elaborate.
Yeah.
And people who have good miniatures... experience. Some people even make them look like an actual little castle tower with bricks
those.
And parapets on the top and windows, and the dice come out into a little castle courtyard in
and
the bottom.
Little Anne Boleyn ghost there up in the upper part of the tower.
That's right. It's really cool, and people get very creative with them. And, you know, there's even portable cardboard ones that you can uh-huh. print out and put together, or people make them out of Legos sometimes. I'll put links to these in the show notes.
All right.
And there is one other dice tower I want to mention, because I bought this one a few years ago, and I've been loving using it ever since. And you have one
yes,
also.
I do. And I actually own more than one.
This is the Dice Boot, which is now seems to be sold by Chessex.
Right.
I did some searches on the web, and that's who the manufacturer is noted as now.
Yeah, the Dice Boot, not DOS Boot. It's Dice Boot.
It's Dice Boot, and it must be a play on DOS Boot, because that's the only thing I can think of. Otherwise, it
right.
doesn't really make sense.
And it does actually look sort of like a boot from the side.
It does look like a boot, and you put dice in it. But other than that, I don't know what the connection is to a German submarine movie that we need to make
that's
about
right.
Dice Towers.
Know.
But anyway, Dice Boot. It's made of transparent acrylic plastic,
yeah.
and you can take it apart for transport in a flat box that it comes in, or I use an old dice bag, and then you can pull it out, quickly assemble it right before the game. I have to say, though, that the Dice Boot in its out-of-the-box state is somewhat less than optimal.
Yes.
It does work, and it's transparent, which is cool. You can see the dice roll through it, and they come out at the bottom.
So you can ensure that you're not substituting dice, like dropping some in the top and having the loaded dice come out the
That's
bottom.
That's right. I don't have a little mechanism or a little gremlin in there that catches the dice and then puts a loaded one coming out the bottom.
That's right.
But the Dice Boot in its out-of-the-box state, that is it's acrylic plastic, and it is very loud, and the parts are not completely tight, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to take it apart.
Right.
So they rattle as the dice go through.
Yeah. The first time I put mine together and ran some dice through it, the clatter from the boot itself shaking a little bit, the clatter from the dice hitting the hard acrylic plastic, and then finally the dice hitting my table actually made enough noise to wake up my sleeping baby. It, totally true. Absolutely true. Ran the dice boot a couple times, baby woke up. It was astounding.
So it's very loud. And in a loud gaming session, this might not be a big deal, but for you and I, who often play at night
That's
at
right.
your house when
After
your kids are asleep,
to bed. Yeah, don't want to wake them up.
We want to minimize the noise. So who needs all that noise?
Yeah.
So we modded the dice boot a little bit. I bought some thick felt from the craft store, and I needed some way to attach it to the plastic of the dice boot. So I went to my favorite glue advice website, thistothat.com. Have you seen this one?
Yeah, you showed it to me. After I had a failed, this is why I own more than one dice boot, is because the first one I thought, oh, I'll just use some of this nifty glue I have, some of this super glue, and it just totally destroyed my acrylic, and it was horrible.
So on this to that, you put in what you want to attach to what, and it recommends an appropriate adhesive.
Oh, sweet! Quick, let's find out how to attach styrofoam to leather. Okay, hold on. thisorthat.com. Oh, LePage's Press Tight Green Contact Cement. Of course. Thank you, thisorthat.com. You've saved the day.
And that leather jacket is going to look great once you get all that packing material glued on. And some people just use the bedazzler. You know, I'm glad you're forging ahead in your own
That's
direction.
Right.
So thistothat.com, they recommended for attaching felt to plastic, they recommended 3M Super 77 spray adhesive, which I had never used before, but it is an amazing product. And, you know, I don't want this to turn into a crafting podcast. But
yes, this is not the craft hour with Adam and Nate.
But I'll tell you, it's spray super glue. You know, you spray it on, press the stuff together, and it's glued, and it's great. It's like getting a whole nice even layer of super glue.
And the best part about that particular thing in dealing with the dice boot, now the dice boot is acrylic, and And the glue that I used that ruined my first dice boot, it would frost. The fumes from it would frost the acrylic, and so the acrylic looks like nasty, scratched up, and frosted just by having glue in the vicinity of it.
Yeah.
And this Super 77 stuff was just... It was just perfect. It was clear, and after you glued on the felt, there was no additional, you know, fume frosting or anything like that. I really should have gone to thisorthat.com if I'd known about it before I ruined my first dice boot.
So, and your dice boot, it's still usable.
It just, oh, yeah, it just looks ugly. Yes, it looks totally crappy.
And so anyway, this Super 77, it's great stuff. And you have to, if you start using a fresh can of it, though, you kind of have to use... the whole can, uh-huh. because if you put it away half used, then glue that's in the nozzle will harden and glue it shut, and you won't ever be able to use it.
Yeah. But what I do with paint is I turn it upside down.
Exactly. And it says that on the can, which I didn't remember to do the first time. But if you remember right before you're done and you put it away, you turn the can upside down and spray it and get some propellant so it cleans out the nozzle. Right.
Okay. Now, I have a feeling that our show is going to get picked up by HGTV,
that's right.
Home and Garden Television.
Yeah, that we're giving some craft and scrapbooking advice.
Yeah, here. let's not go there. So let's move on.
Let's move on. Although I do want to come back to Michael's craft store later on. Anyway, so the dice
boot. Not your cousin Michael, but the craft store.
The actual craft store. So it's a good portable dice tower. Now, the dice boot. I want to talk a little bit about another gaming accessory that I enjoy, and that is markers or counters. Now, what I'm specifically thinking about is something like those flattened glass stones that you see used in a number of games, like in the old Parker Brothers Pente game.
Right.
And game stores sell these, of course. People use them for life stones, all kinds of things.
Right. The Magic the Gathering people used to use those for life counters.
Too. I have a small bag of red ones that I bought about 15 years ago that I used back in college when I used to play Jihad or Vampire the Eternal Struggle, it was later renamed to. And we used these for life points. They were really cool, deep red stones. They worked good for blood points in
blood.
That game. That's right. And they're good for any kind of game in which you need markers on the board or hit points. So first of all, in case anyone hasn't heard this yet, I think this is old news, but I'll say it anyway. You can get really cheap glass flattened stones like that at a craft store or even at a pet store.
Or at the craft store. Sorry.
So there's a chain of craft stores around here called Michael's. I think it's a nationwide U.S. chain.
Yeah.
And I love going to Michael's looking for game components and looking for ways to mod my games. They have all kinds of stuff. One of the things they sell is big bags of these flattened glass stones, which people use for accents in their home decor or to put at the bottom of a glass vase of flowers. And you can get tons of them, and they are way cheaper than the game store.
Yes.
So, as I mentioned, also, you can sometimes find them at pet stores.
Oh.
In the fish section, people use them for the bottoms of fish bowls instead of gravel, and they do look nice that way.
Wow.
So, but Michael's is another good source for these. So I've used, I should not mention also that I've also found these at IKEA recently.
Oh, really?
They have decorative glass stones. They have three colors of them, clear, blue, and green, and each canister had both polished and frosted stones of one color.
I can't imagine they'd be any cheaper than Michael's, though, which sells them like by the gross, big giant buckets of them.
Yeah, so they were, they're good. So I use glass stones like this in all kinds of games, or sometimes they're good for victory points, and I know we used to use counters for slack points when we used to play Shea Geek a lot. Although we often used pennies then because I didn't have enough of the glass stones.
Yeah.
I should have bought the big vase-filling bag of them from Michael's
at
the time.
Or you could have taken all that money that you spent on the vase-filling bag and converted it to pennies. Used all those pennies as well.
Pennies are a good substitute if you need it. They are, of course, they pass the cheapness test and they're ubiquitous. It is nice sometimes to have multiple colors of markers as well.
That's right.
And tails versus heads sometimes just doesn't cut it enough.
And you can't count on new shiny penny versus old old copper penny, yes.
That's right. So so in terms of gaming stones, besides the glass stones, there's something new that's come out that I really liked recently. Mm-hmm. So at KubliCon this year, there was a game in prototype testing called Halley's Hold'em from Three Sages Games. Now, I did not play the game. I saw it out on a table there. But they had these really interesting little plastic crystals that they are using for wagering tokens in the game.
Right.
And they had multiple colors of them, and they looked really cool, and they were even selling them separately at the con. So I bought a couple of 50 packs of them, and I have loved using them since then. And I've gone back to their online store and bought a 50-pack of each of their other colors, too. So now I have all 9 colors.
Wow.
And I think they are a little overpriced for what they are. And here they are. Nathan just got out his.
Yes, I pulled out my set of them.
But I'm going to be using these for a long time, so that's how I justify the price. And they do look really cool. As I'm looking at them now as you pulled them out, and wow, I'm just remembering how much I...
These crystals are irregular. They're really neat that way. They're maybe all identical.
They are all identical and built from a mold, but if you dumped a bunch of these out on a table.
If you dump like 10 of them out, the chance of seeing any 3 or 4 next to each other that looked identical because of which side they land on.
Yeah.
I'm enamored by them. I'm just staring at them now that I've got them out. Really should put them away or the podcast won't go.
These shiny little
anymore.
Gems.
Shiny little gems.
They pick
gems.
Up the light and they're in all these different colors. And so these are really cool. And I have been using these lately for the main use lately is for when I play Duel of Ages. We've been playing that a bit lately. And each character card in Duel of Ages usually has 4 to 6 hit points. We put an appropriate number of these little crystals on each character card. And it's easy then to look across the table and see how many hit points each character has.
Right. And it makes it that much easier to find the guy with 1 hit point and pound him.
That's right.
You can see, oh, he's only got 1 crystal left.
You can't hide it anymore. Yeah. And you could use the big glass gaming stones for this too. But these are smaller and they look cooler too. So I think
they're
work
smaller.
Better.
You can group them together closer than you can with the gaming stones, and they're a ton lighter. So a bag of these is because they're plastic are incredibly light versus the glass, which, you know, I don't know. It depends on how many you're carrying around, but if you're carrying around the big, huge vase-filling bag of stones, you know.
That's a heavy weight.
That's heavy, but these are really light. And I liked them so much after playing Duel of Ages with them, with you and using them as counters that I went out and bought, I think, maybe 7 different colors, 1 pack of,
cool.
I don't even know how many that is, like 30 or something.
They're 50 in each pack.
Are they 50? See, oh, and they fit in such a small area. I could have, I guess, 30, but it was 50. And, yeah, so.
So these are really cool. So I just want to say check out the gaming crystals from Three Sages Games, and I will put a link to their online store in the show notes.
Right.
And every good gamer knows that a good set of markers in several different colors should be part of every gamer's collection of gaming bits.
That's
and
right.
These could be the gaming crystals, they could be little mini poker chips, glass stones, whatever, but something everyone should have, and they're useful in so many games, especially those cheap-ass games where you need to supply your own markers anyway.
Right, supply your own bits. Thank you. Wow, I just wish we got paid for every set of these that somebody was somebody was buying. But they really are great. We're happy customers with them, so check
them out.
That's
right. Maybe I'll email the Three Sages guys and see if I can get a kickback going here.
All right.
I probably shouldn't have said that out loud, should I?
Okay. No. That's it. Let's delete that in the pod.
We'll fix that in post.
Editing. Fix that in post.
Okay, so moving on to
so now I want to talk for a little bit. Yeah, so we're going to switch gears just a little bit away from the... the games. Well, this particular game, though, I'm gonna tie this in a little bit. This particular game has probably one of the most famous game accessories in European games, and that is the meeple. We're gonna be talking about Carcassonne.
That's
and
right.
In Carcassonne, they have the little people-shaped wooden counters, and those I guess are called meeples. So we're going to talk a little bit about Carcassonne.
I thought the singular of meeple was Mersenne.
It very well could be. I thought it was Mindividual.
Mindividual, yes.
Yeah, there you go. See, Mindividual and meeple. All right, so... Now, for those of you that are already clued into the Euro gaming scene, talking about Carcassonne is like talking about the later Jurassic period or something. It's, you know, the limited
old
edition.
History.
Right. It was published in 2000, which in internet time is before most of us were born. But in real life, it was only like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Almost exactly 6 years ago. And Carcassonne was a game that I had heard about when I was when I was learning about Euro games, but didn't actually have an opportunity to play. And I finally had an opportunity to play this at a relative's house, who sort of like, hey, let's play a game. I'm like, all right, what are we gonna play? And he says, have you heard of this game? It's called Carcassonne. And I'm like, oh yeah. And so he was sort of sharing
like
his.
I've been hearing about that for years, and he thought it was this big secret.
That's right. That's right. So. So like I said, it was published in 2000, and there have been other editions and other expansions published severally a year, every year since then. So if you walk into your local gaming store that carries the Euro games, you will find not only Carcassonne, but a giant stack of Carcassonne-related expansions.
Oh yeah, there have
like
been
that.
A ton of expansions.
Yes, and if I remember correctly, and if I had done better research for this, I think it won Spiel des Jahres, so it was a game of the year.
Yeah.
Its designer is Klaus-Jürgen Werde, and for all of you that German... Tough. It's it doesn't get any better than that. So I don't pronounce it any better than that. But he has he's created some awesome games, and Carcassonne is a good one. And it has been published in the U.S. by Rio Grande Games. So for those of you that are fond of the Rio Grande label, that's how you get the English version. I'm talking as if no one has heard of this before. It's 6 years old. It's incredibly old.
I heard about this new game called Settlers. Have you heard of
that? That's right, Settlers. I heard the new game, or this new television show called MASH. It's about wacky doctors. Anyway.
I hope they never cancel that show.
I know, as long as it's playing. Okay, expansions. There are a bunch of different expansions, and I'm just going to name off a couple of them here, and then we'll talk a little bit about why there are expansions to this game. There's Inns and Cathedrals, Traders and Builders, The River, The River 2, The Count of Carcassonne, Carcassonne the Town, Carcassonne the Princess and the Dragon, and Carcassonne the Tower 2006.
Wow.
And there are a number of related games. These are games that are essentially Carcassonne, but are not expansions to the main game. So there's be Carcassonne the Discovery, Carcassonne the Castle, Carcassonne Hunters and Gatherers, and the Ark of the Covenant, which is biblical Carcassonne.
Oh, so it's not based on Raiders of the Lost Ark and
no,
people's
that,
faces
you know,
melting and
let
things
me tell
like
you,
that.
That'd be awesome. If there were a face-melting meeple,
keep
that'd
your eyes
be totally
closed,
cool.
Marion.
Keep your eyes closed. Yeah. No, not happening. So as you can tell, there have been lots of different expansions to this. So this game you can play it in its most basic form, or you can buy some expansions for it. Actually, you may not even be able to play it in its basic original form. You were telling me about your copy that you
bought recently. I bought a copy for my cousin Michael, who I mentioned earlier, for his birthday, and the Carcassonne that I bought actually had the River expansion in it, so it was basic game plus the River. The River tiles were marked separately on the back, so you could remove them if you didn't want to play with those, but it does come with that expansion.
See, there you go.
At least the version I bought.
Chances are, if you don't own Carcassonne, you go out and you want to buy a copy now, you'll already get something that your neighbor already had to pay extra for. So, anyway, so this game, I really don't know what else to say about it, because we've heard all sorts. There are lots of people that do game reviews, especially in podcasts and on the web. So I'm not sure I want to review it as much as I just want to talk about it a little bit, little bit about my experience. It's a tile placement game. For those that don't know, you draw a tile and you essentially build the map out of the tiles, and it's sort of an area control game for scoring. So you put down your little meeples and you take command and control of various geographic features that get done on the map, and that's how you score. I went and looked at Board Game Geek to see what they had to say, and it's in the category of gateway game. So I'm assuming it's one of the marijuana of European gaming, I guess.
You give them one taste and they get hooked. That's right.
You give them a taste, they get hooked, and then they get the munchies and quit their job. So, no.
I think you're supposed to. This is one of those ones that you show to people who are not used to any games other than what they find at Target.
Right.
And they say, "What? Why is this not made by Milton Bradley? What kind of game is this?" And then you play it, and then they realize there's a whole world of other games out there.
There you go.
Opens the door.
Great. Yeah, exactly. And it's the sort of thing that, like, for example, the person that invited me to play was not entirely aware. I mean, well, I guess maybe he was aware that I liked to play games, but, he was like, "Well, have you heard of this brand new one? Or I've just heard about this game." And he was sort of trying to get me into his game circle by presenting Carcassonne. It's a 2 or 3 player game, unless you get an expansion. If you get one of the expansions, then you get more players to the game. Tom Vassell, the sainted Tom Vassell of the DiceTower.com.
I wasn't aware he had been beatified recently.
He's had a number of miracles happen in his presence, some of which are that his podcast continues to go on regardless of how bad it is. So, no, I'm sorry. I listen to the Dice Tower, often and constantly for a while, and eventually I stopped, and we'll leave that at that. So he rated it 9 out of 10.
Okay,
as a game, and it's one of those must plays for him. And he plays it with his with his children and other family members, and
definitely
do that. So, and another good another good review of this game was Paul Tevis of Have Games Will Travel, which is a great podcast, and I want to put that one in the show notes because that's one I still listen to. Paul Tevis's Have Games Will Travel did a review or a session report of Carcassonne, and I really enjoyed it.
And we'll put links to both of those shows in the show notes.
Totally. Well, do we have to do the link to the Dice Tower?
We don't. We can put a URL that you have to copy
there
and paste
in. Someone actually has to copy. You can't accidentally get there. Good. Okay. So in gameplay, gameplay is really easy. You draw a tile. You place the tile to match the picture that's on the terrain. So if you've got a tile that has a road on it, you have to connect it to an existing road that's on the map.
Right.
And then after you've placed your tile, you can place a meeple. You can place one of these little...
But you have to place it on the tile you just played.
Right.
Or not at all.
Or not at all. So you put it down or not at all. And then if you complete certain geographic features, like a road from point to a point or a city that's entirely enclosed, then you score with that meeple. The meeple is taken off the board. You get a score on the score track. And then you can reuse that meeple somewhere else. And that's it. It's a really easy concept.
Yep. And you only have a limited number of meeples. You have like 7 or 8 of them, I forget.
Right.
And so you want to place them such that they can be reused, or place them as farmers, and farmers never get to be reused. You have to wait till the very end of the game.
Right. So that's the next thing I want to talk about is that once you've gone beyond that very basic step, the easy concept, draw a tile, place a tile, place a meeple, score with the meeple, or not, and then it's place the meeple off of the geographic feature, which is making them a farmer in the game.
Putting them in the field.
Putting them in the field rather than on the road or whichever, or in the city or whatnot. Then those meeples are left there until the end of the game, at which point they're scored at the end of the game. So you can choose to score in these bits along the way and reuse your meeple, or you can set them to score later in the hopes of having a much better score from having those pieces out of your out of rotation.
Right. So. Right.
Anyway, so it was a really easy game and easy to teach. Good concepts, and it's nice and colorful. And it's you build a map, and it's nifty just to see what the map looks like.
Yeah, the graphics look nice, and I love games that have a random map. So this is something I liked about this game also.
That would explain Duel of Ages as well.
I like the random map there too.
There you go. So. And we'll keep referring to the game Duel of Ages until we actually do a podcast about it.
That's right.
So sorry to wet everyone's whistle beforehand. All right, so I'll talk a little bit about the session. My initial impressions were, when I first started playing, I went, ooh, neat tiles, ooh, cool map building, yippee, it's a famous German game, I'm in with the in crowd. And I thought Mark Johnson of Board Games to Go would have been very proud of me.
He would have for
being in with the in crowd and doing the German board game. And as the game went on, and I think we played 2 games of it that night, as the game went on, I had some other thoughts creeping into my head that were beyond yippee and neat tiles. And some of them was, man, it takes a long time to decide where to place these things.
You were having a bit of analysis paralysis,
as they
call it.
That is what they call it. It is, you've drawn your tile, and you look around, and you're trying to figure out, well, where can I score, where can I not? And everyone is waiting for you to decide that, and everyone's staring at you and at the board.
And in this game, there's no... There's nothing you can do when it's not your turn.
Right.
So when it's your turn, you are holding up everyone else.
Yes.
The longer you wait.
Yeah, so unless everyone's having a good time talking about other things and having a frosty beverage and a snack, then chances are everyone's staring at you, waiting for you to decide where to place it.
I wonder if it would help or hurt to play with a chess clock while you do this.
Oh, there you go.
Would that make it more tension?
More tension building or less? I don't know.
You'd at least have a time limit.
Yeah, one of the other thoughts that I had was, man, if I miss something, somebody else scores big time. Yeah, every once in a while I missed a place to put something that was a major score, and I put it somewhere else, got a minor score, and the next person that came along goes, boom, and like totally, totally scored on me.
Can't miss anything.
Yeah, you can't. You gotta be good at it. It's very unforgiving as far as the scoring is. And And then the other thing that I thought about was, man, I hope no one notices this little corner that I have going on here where I'm about to score big time.
I think that was probably wishful thinking.
I think it was.
There's no hidden information in this game.
That's right.
So, you know.
I was sort of hoping that other people were working in other sections of the board and wouldn't notice that I was
not looking at the other side of the board.
The world's largest city that I was going to score tremendously for or whatever. Yeah, so... And then, after a while, I started wishing I knew the tile distribution, because I'd be waiting for something to come up,
yeah.
Like, wow, I really need a city corner from this, you know, and...
When I played this game, we opened the box, and one of the sheets in the box is a sheet that tells you the tile distribution.
Oh, see, they didn't show me that
one. Pictures of each tile and how many of them there are. And we were passing that around during the game, so you could be like, oh, I need a piece with a road that turns right. Oh, okay, there's 7 of those out there, and there's 9 in the game, so there's 2 left.
There's only 2 left. Oh, they didn't show me that sheet.
See, they should have showed you that.
They put me at a disadvantage.
I know, that's not fair.
Because I really needed to know the distribution of the, or I felt like I needed to.
Yeah, it helps you because you're like, okay, I need to finish this city, and I need an end cap set piece, and how many of those are there left in the game, yeah.
Right. And then my final thought that I had while I was playing it was, I wish I could score this with a whiteboard or something besides the track, you know, the little score track.
Why is that?
Well, I didn't trust the scoring as it was going on.
Oh.
So as you'd score and then you'd put down your, you move your 3 points or whatever, you know, no one could remember, did I already score for that? Did I move for that? Could we do, and if you had it as a whiteboard, you could do it per turn. You could say, this turn I scored and I scored 4. This turn so-and-so, you know, scored and they scored 2 or whatever. And you could at least track, oh, we're in turn 7 now, but nobody scored. No, but Bob here scored this turn, and we'd be able to see that.
So here, if I can go back to our earlier discussion of gaming stones, maybe this would be a use for that. Because as you, let's say each person has a different color of these little gaming crystals.
Right.
As you score a road and remove your meeple, you could put a gaming crystal of your color down on that road. And now everyone knows that you've scored that, and at any time later, you can go back and count up those points, but you still get your meeple back.
Ah, that's great.
I might try that next time.
Let's do that. Let's do that. That would have helped with the scoring a lot, because everyone... No one had photographic memory and was able to put together what happened last turn or this turn, and there were all sorts of discussions as to whether or not so-and-so got their 2 points or not. So
I see. Okay.
So that's something. So I wish I'd had some better score tracking for it. And, well, needless to say, since I played the game, I won. Because this is what happens when I play games. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, you know, you're playing against these non-heavy gamers like you.
That's right. There you go. Well, so here's this actually brings up something. After I won, the guy who invited me to play was incredibly nonplussed. And I said, what's wrong? And he's a very easygoing guy. And I found out why he was nonplussed, and it was not because he lost.
Yeah.
It was because I won, which is different. Now, as weird as that sounds, because it was the first time I'd ever played, he is under, this is his, one of his guides to gaming life, is that it's not a good game if a first-time player can win.
Now, you see, that just sounds, A, that sounds like sour grapes to me.
Okay.
And B... You know, one of my philosophies in gaming is that when I teach a game to someone else, sometimes I'll even hold back so that they win the first game.
Right,
and
right.
And then they want to play it again.
That's right. That's how you get them in.
At least with certain people I know who wouldn't play again if they lost the first time.
Right.
Not
right.
You, but no, there are some people who are...
I can take it in a chin, but there are other people who won't.
But you know, that's something that, you know... I totally disagree with that.
I'm gonna play his advocate, although I don't necessarily agree with it either.
What would his reasoning be on that?
His reasoning has to do with good play and bad play, or strategy. If you have a game that's a strategy game, people should know. People that have played several times should have worked out some sort of cohesive strategy, things that work better than other things. And the guy seeing it for the first time should not have that library of knowledge in order to play. And so they don't have the strategic depth to beat someone that does. It's very much like the chess analogy in his thing.
Uh-huh.
A grandmaster is almost always going to beat the new player, mm-hmm. because the grandmaster has 4,000 different chess moves in his head, and the new player has 3.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Despite the fact that there's no hidden information in chess, it's just a matter of practice and thinking ahead and being able to think 4 moves ahead instead of 2 like the beginning player can.
Right, exactly.
And that's a huge difference. And in this game, in Carcassonne, You know, there's one difference is that you have randomness, right?
Yes.
The tile draw
is
may
totally
favor
random.
You, it may not favor you, so that's an effect.
Right.
Which I think is a point against him, because maybe the new player draws great tiles or draws exactly the tile they need, you know, and they could totally win every time. Maybe you are just that much better at thinking about strategic games like this than he is.
Well, see, that's my point of view, but I don't know.
That he just, you know, was not prepared to play against someone of your caliber. I don't know.
Oh, there we go. I'm putting that on my wall right there. You are not prepared to play against a player of my caliber.
I think you could sell T-shirts like that at KubaCon.
Oh, I bet I could. $30 a pop.
There you go.
And then on the back, an ad for Roll2D6 podcast. So
I see it now. and you know, if it's a game that's a lot of randomness, like Candyland or something.
I love Candyland because it's hilarious.
You have small kids, I'm sure.
I do. I play it several times a week.
Hi-ho, so. Cheerio, and yeah. And you know that there's very little strategy in that
That's
game.
That's right. Chutes and ladders. You just go.
First time player has as much chance to win as an experienced Candylander.
That's true.
But a game that does have strategy, you know, that's the point. The strategic player should have more of an effect. But, you know, maybe you're just that much better at it. And so I think it's just sour grapes on his part.
Okay, well.
I think he's just not used to having someone who actually thinks more analytically about it. And, you know, maybe he only plays against his wife or against other players that don't think to that level.
Right. Or, you know, if he's trying to introduce people to gaming, there are maybe people that don't have experience with strategic or analytical thinking and therefore play worse.
And the other thing you were saying is that, you know, and one of the rules in the game is that you put the tile out and you put it face up so that everyone can see it.
Right.
And everyone there can, if they want, give you suggestions about where to play it.
Right.
And since it was your first game, they were helping you out and saying, oh, you could put it here, but that would not be as good as if you put it over here, or this would open it up for someone else.
Exactly.
And so you were not using just your own brain, but plus some fraction of each of their brains.
Absolutely. I was drawing on the combined experience of the other people playing the game, and every time I had it out there, somebody would say, well, you know, if you put it over here, you could score there, and all of them were people that know me and like me. And none of them were trying to screw me over. And so none of them were giving me bad advice. Each one was giving me good advice. And they may be conflicting, but both of them were their best guess at a next move. So that's what I told him afterward. He's like, oh, no. And I said, no, I actually didn't play this game as much as all three of you played against all three of you. Because I was just taking your advice on where I should put these. And that made him feel better. So he'll come over to my house now.
So he'll play again
against you
now. He'll
talk to me. He won't kick my children as he walks by. So
that's always good. So, you know, this statement, it's not a good game if a first-time player can win. Yeah. I'm gonna call that busted. I've been watching Mythbusters too much.
It is. It's busted. All right. So the top complaints that I've seen about the game, and maybe a couple that I've experienced myself, are the randomness in the tiles.
Now, this is that's something you can't get away from that in this game unless you are going to do something, like change the game completely by, like, dealing out the tiles and allowing you to draw one from your hand and place them down.
Or you could do something like Ticket to Ride, where you put out five or whatever, and you can choose one of those. So
no,
it's still
true. That would reduce the randomness.
Right. So,
but it's still there.
Yeah, and my response to this particular complaint is, so what? You know, all games must, in my mind, include a bit of randomness that you've got to either manage or deal with. And
people just complain because, you know, any game that involves luck or a die roll or random tile draw, it could come out in your favor in one game and not in your favor in the next game. But, you know, the answer to that is to play the game again.
That's right.
And then play it again. And you know, the randomness will even out over time.
That's right. And eventually, after you play the game 10,000 times, you'll have a perfect bell curve of the times you've, you know, done well, done poorly, and it'll be great.
That's right. So the answer to that is more gaming.
There you go.
that's my answer for everything, isn't it?
That's right. It's your answer for it all. It's world peace, more gaming.
The car won't start this morning. More gaming.
More gaming. All right. And the other top complaint that I've seen is the analysis paralysis of taking too much time between drawing the tile and placing the tile. Now, when we talked before the show, you had an interesting idea for what we could do to reduce that. And it had to do with the order, the turn order. Rather than drawing a tile, then placing a tile, What you do is you have an existing tile, you place a tile, place a meeple, score with the meeple, and then draw a tile. And so now you have the entire turn around the board again to look at your tile, look at what's on the board, and yes, it's going to change as everyone else puts one down, but hopefully you will have come up with a first, second, third, and fourth choice.
Yeah.
So by the time you get around to your side, you may be at your first choice, or you may be at your third choice, or whatever, but at least you have already looked at it and you know where to go.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't read on the Board Game Geek page or anything about variants. This is just something I just thought of when you described the game to me. I hadn't even played it at that point.
Right.
and I was like, hey, how about just draw one at the end, and then you can look at it the whole time around, and I'm going to try that in my next game and see if that reduces the amount of think time that people have.
Right. So I really like that. When you brought that up as an idea, I thought, wow, I had to really try this, and I had to check and see if the people on Board Game Geek have come up with a similar idea, because, well,
yeah,
they always do.
There's
always
a zillion variants.
Yeah, and there's probably, what, a single combat variant where after you place a tile, you have to, you know, beat someone in unarmed combat. I don't know. There are all kinds of variants that people
I like that idea.
On the geek make. Isn't it cool?
Someone mentioned
like Thunderdome and Carcassonne together. It'd be great. Two meeples enter, one meeple leaves.
Yeah, I wanted to do some kind of variant where you build this map, you score points, and then you have these various cities and roads, and now you do some kind of war game on that map. And I haven't worked that out yet, but we'll figure that out.
We can fight on it. All right. And then the big meeples are worth twice the armor points than the small maybe. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
But doing the drawing at the end and looking at it, or even having a hand of tiles so right. that you can have a choice of what to play, either one of those would be good. That was another variant I saw on the website.
Right. So that's two possible ways to get around these top complaints that I've seen. All in all, I thought it was an interesting and good game. Is it one that I'd play a lot? Well, only if I were trying to get people into gaming, because there are other ones that I like more. Is it one that, you know, possibly you and your family might enjoy? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I played this with my wife and my aunt and my cousin Michael, and my wife liked it so much, she definitely said she wanted to play it again. So.
Hey, wow. She's not even a gamer.
No, she's not. So that's a good sign. So I'm going to pick this one up again.
Excellent, excellent. Well, invite me over next time
I will.
Play and you have that. So great. So that is Carcassonne.
Cool.
And you'll never be able to spell it correct.
I was telling some people about this game and people that, you know, it's named after a town in France, I believe,
mm-hmm.
or a city in France. But people who don't know that, you know, they think it has something to do with dead bodies.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's carcass.
It looks like carcass. And they're like, oh, Carcass 1? I don't know. And you're like, no.
Carcass 1. That's... That's what I'll call it from now on.
And that would be the name of a great spaceship, like Silent Death or something. The Carcass 1.
Carcass 1, named after Carcassonne. That's
there
great.
There you go.
Awesome. All right, so that's Carcassonne.
Well, you've wasted another day listening to Roll 2D6.
Wow, this podcast went on longer than I thought.
And we're really glad you could come.
Yes, and we'll be back at some indeterminate time in the future.
If you like the podcast and you want other people to listen to it, please tell them about it. And if you can go write us up a review at either Yahoo Podcast Reviews or our favorite is the iTunes Music Store Podcast Review, we'd greatly appreciate it. We've already gotten one, and it was positive, and it made my day. And
yes.
And as a matter of fact, I think I even got a little misty reading it.
it was nice to hear that someone out there is actually listening. Or send us an email, roll2d6@gmail.com, or leave a comment on the blog at www.roll2d6.com.
Yeah, you can always leave a message on the blog. Tune in next time when you may hear Adam say,
anyone want to play Dungeons & Dragons for the next quadrillion years?
Sure,
yes,
I guess.
On to Rook 8.
I'm a 10th level vice president.